Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral arguments this morning is Lewis Steinmetz Appellant versus the State of South Dakota Bureau of Personnel Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Jason Groves, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Timothy Engel, an attorney from Pierre. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Pat Rypel, Circuit Judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Zinner's place. Mr. Groves, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, Mr. Justice Gilbertson, other esteemed members of this honorable court, Mr. Engel. I have a few prepared brief remarks that I'd like to make, and then that I'd like to set the stage of this. I have represented job-injured employees for more than 30 years. During this time, I have witnessed changes in various statutes that define benefits for the injured worker. This case is about my client, Mr. Steinmetz, who, while working as a youth counselor, suffered injuries that disabled him to his neck, his mid, and low back. As a result, he was unable to return to his job, and he lost the ability to work at gainful employment. He was the sole wage earner in his family, providing for himself and his wife. His weekly wage at the time of his injury was $504 a week. His workers' compensation benefit payment, as prescribed by the statute, was two-thirds of that wage, or $336 a week. He incurred attorney fees, costs of litigation, and demonstrating and proving his disability claim, which reduced his weekly benefit to
Just a minute, Shirley. The clock's got to start. You get some 3 minutes off us.
Thank you, Your Honor.
There you go. Okay.
Okay, we're running now. Thank you. In any event, his wage was $504. His comp rate was established at $336 after the cost of his litigation, and his fees established and paid at 25% plus costs and tax. His weekly wage was reduced to $245 a week. This was a very real loss. It was more than 50% of his income. He lost $260 a week, $1,120 monthly, $13,470 a month. These are facts in the record. It establishes, in my mind, and I think under the law of this jurisdiction, that he suffered an exceptional financial need resulting directly from his work injury.
Is that a stipulated part of the agreement here, that he did, in fact, suffer an exceptional financial need? I know you're quoting the language of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. It is not a stipulated fact. What I'm suggesting to you, in my mind, and under the law of this jurisdiction, the law requires an exceptional financial need. And I think it has to fit nicely within best interests, too. I don't think it's entirely clear. But what I'm suggesting is the facts of this case, moving a man from $504 a week after cost of litigation to prove his disability, which is eventually admitted, took him to $245.
You know, with your experience, though, 30 years, couldn't we say that about almost every person who's totally disabled?
You can in some instances. I mean, you certainly can say that, but you'd be creating... There are some cases where people get hurt, and the case is admitted. They don't suffer the loss of the litigation. That's number one. And there are, you know, I think it depends on the level of wages. There's a number of different things that affect it.
I'm I'm not seeing the distinction, to be honest with you, because the amount of sufficient exceptional issues, wouldn't that be the same regardless of the workers? Or if someone made a lot of money as opposed to a little money, each one of those on a lump sum would certainly suffer the same type of what you're saying, exceptional loss, just at a different rate.
Yes.
So in your situation then, we would have to do it in every particular case.
I think each case has to stand on its own. I think that argument could be made, but I think each case has to stand on its own. I can tell you this.
Then how do you develop any type of general policy that reduces the ability to do that?
Well, I don't know if that's the policy of this state. And that's the next point I wanted to go to. I think the policy of this state has been well stated and well developed.
Should the argument be made to us, or should the argument be made to the legislature that workman's comp benefits are just inadequate?
I think that's an issue to be addressed to the legislature. I can tell you, and I think it's clear from the few authorities that are on point, that in the Thomas case, and you know, I was here at that time, the court clearly has said the purpose of a lump sum award in a compensation case is made with the goal of preserving future wage replacement benefits. Now, I know that the law, we continuously say lump summing is the exception to the rule. But I think lump summing is misunderstood. Our statutes say you can get a lump sum. The case says lump summing is an exception to the rule. But if you go to the discussion of the court in Anger, and I'm going to refer you to, it's hard for me to follow these new sites to find the exact page, but preceding what appears to be double asterisk 12 on my copy, it says, if a totally disabled worker gives up these reliable periodic payments in exchange for a large sum of cash in hand, experience has shown that in many cases the lump sum was dissipated and the injured worker is right back, blah, blah, blah. The point is, what this court has done by creating a test or standard for lump summing has taken the cash out of the hands of the injured worker. The injured worker doesn't get a lump sum. He doesn't get cash. He gets a plan of investment. He has to show the court, he has to show the department that he has something that will benefit him, that's something that will help him, that will keep benefits for his lifetime. So this issue about a lump sum, and the law is replete with this. Larson has it, Wolfer Swanson has it, Anger has it, Thomas has it. We continuously repeat this mantra about lump summing being the exception to the rule. But lump summing in this context, as demonstrated in Anger, is to get cash in hand. Anger didn't get a lump sum because even though she wanted to buy a home. Because even though she would save arguably $6,000 a year, it would be cash in hand even if it was put into a residence. And this honorable court said, no, we want to preserve a future stream of income for the disabled worker, and the issue is we didn't want it dissipated. Entirely appropriate and reasonable, in my opinion. Because what it does is it allows the injured worker with the income to go buy the home, to pay the bills. Connie Thomas had a clearly honorable, reasonable reason for wanting a partial lump sum. She wanted to take her family and her husband and travel to Korea to see her aged mother that had never met her children. I thought that was reasonable. The Department of Labor considered it reasonable. This court said no. And I certainly understand why. You want to preserve the continued stream of income. In that case, the state argued that the annuity was reasonable, that taking the money and diverting it from that purpose of the annuity was unreasonable. And that's the law that we have lived with since whenever Thomas was announced by this court. Thomas announces this whole set of facts, this litany of tests. The problem with tests of all these other issues, these other factors are laid out by the court. The problem with a litany of tests is they don't necessarily address the diversion of money from a plan of investment. They provide ways to get money in lump sum.
Excuse me, so really is it your position that if anyone brings forth a plan, that they should be awarded the lump sum? In essence?
In essence, if it's financially sound, if it meets the requirements of the court as laid out, the answer is yes.
So you're proposing basically what some politicians have said is privatizing Social Security, that you can do better on the private market than in the payout formula that the state's got.
No, I don't think that's what I'm arguing. Privatization is different. That's an issue of where you take the money and you give it to a person and he makes investment decisions. And those investment decisions can rise or fall depending on the vicissitudes of the investor and the marketplace. That's different. When a plan of investment is presented to the department and is presented to this court, there's no vicissitudes of the market. There's no chance of losing. The plan of investment is spendthrift, non-assignable, for a lifetime. It meets every standard that this court has set out. Privatization is different because there's every reasonable you can assign benefits. You can withdraw them early, and the market can fluctuate and change the return. That's the problem with privatization, in my opinion. What this court has done is explained that the lump sum can't come to the hands of the injured worker. And the vehicle that has been used to accomplish that purpose is an annuitized form of investment that is safe. And so, what do we do?
So are you advocating then that we step away from the writings in Thomas and Inger and some of the cases that you've, the other cases that you've cited, and take a more liberal approach to it?
No. I'm saying Thomas and Inger establish that if claimant can show financial best interests, this goes back to the financial best interest thing, that he is, I think, at least as well off, if not better off, with a lump sum for money for regular continuous payments over the course of his lifetime, that there is absolutely no reason that that should not be allowed.
As a practical matter, is it always challenged by the insurance company that you have to go before the, I suppose this is all on the side here, and I don't know if this is in the record, but I guess curiosity, is this something that you would regularly take before the department and the department makes the decision, or is this something that would at times be just decided or agreed upon between the parties?
My experience, and the experience I'm aware of, I can tell you before the law was in place, I had to try two cases. I had to try a disability case if I didn't settle it. I had to try the disability case. And then I had to try a lump sum petition. And because of the law has now been answered, but I was fearful that I couldn't get paid. I couldn't recover my costs. And I had to get a lump sum through an annuity vehicle. And I was successful doing that. Now, that raises another question. Another issue in my mind. The Pacesetter case, you know, that's the name of the employer that's cited by the state here. This case is illustrative of the problems that injured workers and consulate had in obtaining lump summing after an admitted or an adjudicated total disability case. As a matter of fact, one of the cases cited in this decision was one that I tried before the Department of Labor, and I didn't appeal it because I couldn't understand why it could be denied. The problem is, after the statute was changed, allowing lump sum for attorney fees, then we go back and we're faced with this 1%, this jumps ahead of my argument, faced with this 1%, 3% deal. And you can never beat it. I mean, it's just like, you can't do it. How can I say if I get money, it's present valued in the future at 1%, I can go do an investment and beat a 3% continued investment? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So there's a case I didn't hear, Odell versus Dorset Nursing. Oh, that's my case. And when I tried the case and I got the adverse decision and I saw Mr. Frankenfeld or whoever testified for me, it's no different than this one. You know, it's like lines in a chart and, you know, the line goes up like this if you get 3%. And the annuity stays level. And I'm thinking, geez, you know, this is right. There's something wrong here. How do I explain what's going on? I can't understand it myself. So, unfortunately,
do you think on that issue that you've raised that the legislature should set the amount itself, the percentage, or should they tie it to something?
No, I think what's happened here is the legislature has, you know, they have provided an authority, the enabling statute, 6276, that does everything they need to do. But what the Department of Labor has done in their AR, they have created a rule that caps the cost of living increases to 1% when 6247 clearly says, and, you know, it's clear, in total disability cases, you get 100% of the cost of living increase, the COLA, up to 3%. I mean, it's just clear as day. It doesn't change. And that's in, it specifically says, in total disability cases. But we come over on the other side, after the enabling statute and with the AR, they cut it down, well, but in cases of total disability, you get 1%. And I'm going, so this is, you know, this is recent that I've seen this. I've seen it all along, but I look at this now and I say, gee, why didn't I see this before? You know, I feel like I should have seen it. I read it enough times, but I didn't see it.
When was that?
When did I notice this?
No, when was the rule passed?
I think it's like 94. Oh, the AR? Well, it was passed. I think the enabling statute is 94, 95, and it's been in place since then.
Okay.
And so, and
it's
I don't...
It's always been the 1%.
I beg your pardon?
It's always been that 1%?
To my memory,
okay.
Yes. To my memory, yes.
Unless your client chooses to stay on the payment plan, in which case he would get the 3%, up to 3%.
Yes.
So it's only when he's wanting a lump sum, the 1%, you're stuck with the 1%, according to the department.
Yes. Yes. And so... So
let me ask you this. If, first of all, the first hurdle is to get over whether or not there was an error in denying the lump sum. Is that correct? You need us to reverse that. And then you're asking us to then go back and say, if we're granting, if it should be, the lump sum should have been granted, then we have to go back and readdress whether it should have been at the 1% or the 3%. Correct? And to do that, we have to determine whether or not the statute is unconstitutional.
You know, I've wrestled.
If it's unconstitutional, you have to meet the burden of beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, I don't know if that's the standard, Your Honor. And I struggle with the question you asked. And this sounds, I know this is going to sound self-serving, but I respectfully disagree. I represented Mr. Steinmetz, and I think it is clear that the only way counsel can represent these people is if they receive a fee based on the present value of the case. So I think this and there's a stipulation in this record preserving that right. And it's recognized that that's part of this case.
So you want us to, if we go along with the court at, in effect saying it was correct and saying it was denying the lump sum, that we should reevaluate the cost at a 3% for your attorney's fees?
I'm saying that...
As opposed to being the lump sum on a 1%.
Right. I'm saying that the issue is what is... Does the AR produce an equivalent lump sum value, a lump sum amount? And if it doesn't, what is it? That's part of this case. And I don't mean to be self-serving, but these are the issues that are presented.
Say that again.
This appeal.
Restate that again.
When counsel represents injured workers, the statutes provide that counsel is paid a percentage, up to a percentage, based on the lump sum amount. And part of this appeal is protecting that interest. And I don't mean it to be self-serving. If it sounds that way, I don't mean it to be. And so to simply say, if we agree with the department, then we don't address this issue. This appeal is, does the AR produce an equivalent lump sum value? And that issue is there. And I mean, it's not esoteric. It's a real fundamental issue. And there are cases that are dependent on this and whether this AR is accurate.
So in a sense, what you're saying, I think, is that even if we were to deny your client the lump sum, we ought to look at the lump sum awarded to you, if not just for you, if for all injured workers who have to convince lawyers to take their cases.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. Does the AR establish an equivalent lump sum amount as is provided and required by the enabling statute? I see my time has expired.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Grills. Mr. Engel, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court?
Before you start, is it stipulated that that issue should be addressed, whether or not the rules on the 1% on the lump sum, that we still need to address that even if we affirm the denial of the lump sum?
I would not say that it's directly stipulated, and I don't mean to...
But you don't object to it, or...?
Well, I don't think the court has to do that. In fact, I think the court can and should stop if it determines that a lump sum is appropriately denied. Now, in fairness to Mr. Groves, the stipulation talks about the fact that he can request an additional attorney fee if a larger lump sum is awarded. I don't know that that means that this court has to get to that point. And also, in fairness and in full disclosure, at oral argument before Judge Anderson, at that point, Mr. Groves sort of had me convinced that he was right on that point. I've since changed my mind, and I don't think he's right on that point, and I don't know that my mistake is binding on the court, but I wanted you to be aware of that.
Well, I guess I'm confused now, because what I understand Mr. Groves to say is that we have to decide two lump sum questions. One is, well, he's entitled to a percentage of the lump sum, even if there isn't a lump sum award, right?
No, I would disagree with that. He's not entitled to a specific percentage of the lump sum. He is entitled to, I'm sure he has a contingent fee agreement with his client that says that he gets a certain percentage. But it's ultimately up to the department and a reviewing court to decide what his fee would be. The percentages that are in 62.736 are caps. They aren't minimums, they're maximums. And I've seen other cases where, with a relatively small number of hours, claimant's counsel has obtained a good result for their client. and wanted 25% of a very large award for just a few hours' worth of work. Now, should they be paid their hourly rate for those few hours? Probably not, because there are other factors involved. But should they be entitled to 25% of a $300,000 present value? Probably not. So I would respectfully disagree with that assertion.
But the attorney's fees are paid out in a lump sum. Is that department policy?
The attorney's fees are paid out of the... Ultimately, the claimant pays the attorney's fees.
Right.
That's true. Out of whatever award.
It's claimant's money, but the department's got their hands on it, right?
It's the claimant's money that... Yes.
Okay.
The department has control over it.
All right.
But should the attorney's fee be based on the value of it? Well, that would be represented by a 3% COLA or a 1% COLA. Is that the question?
Could you restate that?
Do you evaluate the 25%, which is the lump sum attorney's fee, do you evaluate what the present worth of it is based on 1% or 3% COLA?
Well, with all due respect, again, I think that starts from the what I would submit is a false premise that the council is entitled to a specific percentage. Granted, again, no doubt their contingent fee agreement says that, but if it's a few hours worth of work that leads to a $300,000 recovery, should that entitle council to 25% of the $300,000?
But that doesn't affect the decision that we have to make here today. I mean, that will still be a process that the department can go through. If we decide that their rules are not in conformity with state law and say that they've gone beyond the directive of the legislature, what you're talking about, that's still going to be part of all the approval process. But the legislature has clearly said and recognized the workers' compensation claimants can go in if they can't pay their attorney's fees. And obviously, if everybody challenges these, insurance company, the state, or whatever, they have to hire a lawyer. The way the workers' compensation program has morphed into it, you know, it's a legal process now. So the legislature's recognized that they have to hire a lawyer and they have to pay for it. And so they can go in and ask for a lump sum just for their lawyer if they can't pay for it.
That's correct.
So don't we have to, I guess, following through, don't we have to deal with that statute and the lump sum, or the not so much the statute, but the rule that the Labor Department passed? I don't know how we can avoid that.
Well, I think the way that you can and should avoid that is to go back to my first statement that it's up to the department initially to decide what the attorney fee should be. It's not, we sort of all workers' compensation practitioners, I think that on both sides, the department, and maybe to a certain extent to the courts, sort of fall into this trap that these percentages in 62.736 are fixed and that's what it will be. And that's not the case. They are ceilings. And my point, Your Honor, is
well,
that
the ceiling then is lower with the 1% as opposed to the 3.
That's true. That is true.
So the department could cut the attorney's fee down at the time you're talking about to 22% or 20% or 18% or 15%, but it could be 15% then of the present value based on a 3% COLA rather than a 1%.
That's correct. The department could do that if this court determines that the administrative rule was improperly adopted or is being improperly administered. But
isn't it more beneficial to the claimant that the attorney's fees be based upon, when we're looking for the lump sum, on the 1% as opposed to the 3%?
Well, if you're talking about...
If we're just saying we're not entitled to a lump sum, but we're going to look at the lump sum for purposes of awarding the attorney's fees, isn't it more beneficial to the claimant, the beneficiary here, to be based on a 1% as opposed to the 3%?
Yes.
And
why?
Isn't the benefit, aren't we looking at the benefit of the person who was injured as opposed to the benefit of the attorney? Although there's a need to have the attorney be given a good attorney, when we're looking at the benefit as to who in the end result, isn't it to the person who was injured as opposed to the attorney?
Well, of course, the purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act is to compensate injured workers. The courts have recognized, and I think we'd all agree, that it's important that injured workers have access to counsel. That's true. But the primary purpose of the Workers' Compensation Act is to provide compensation for injured workers. And to sort of answer the why, what would happen is if this court determined that the administrative rule is improper, that the lump sum that the department calculates for the purpose of calculating attorney's fees should be significantly higher, then, just to use 25% as an example, instead of claimant's counsel receiving 25% of $100,000, he might receive 25% of $150,000.
But that would be in the best interest of the client when the hiring takes place in the first place, because, in other words, the client could say, you know, based on what the department approves, the department could approve a 20% attorney's fee as opposed to a 25% attorney's fee because it's going to be based on a 3% COLA. So why isn't that in the best interest of the client? It doesn't come out of his pocket.
I would disagree with that. It does come out of his pocket. It comes out of the client's pocket because if there's, and again, we're assuming that there's no lump sum award, that the claimant continues to receive weekly benefits over their lifetime. Those weekly benefits are reduced in proportion to what's paid to the lawyer. So, you know, instead of it being a $300 weekly benefit, using the current rule, maybe it's a $250 weekly benefit. If the court throws out the current rule, then it's a $200 weekly benefit.
Well, that's only if he doesn't get the lump sum. He's better off with the 3% if he gets the lump sum and pays his lawyer based on the 3%.
That's true. But, of course, that assumes, and I guess that's sort of where I had intended to start here, the claimant here is really, excuse me, my arms aren't as long as they used to be. The claimant on page 2 of his reply brief has argued this. He said that the standard should be as follows for determining whether a lump sum should be awarded. Quote, a financial analysis under which a claimant must establish that payment of a lump sum will result in regular, continuous income over the claimant's lifetime. That's the standard he has proposed in his brief. Now, if that is the standard, any claimant who comes to the department and says, I have a good annuity plan in place that's going to pay me over my lifetime, it's guaranteed for my life, and it's not a 10-year or 20-year plan, is going to meet that standard, and they'll be entitled to a lump sum. Now, if that happens, that's wholly inconsistent with three things this court has said in the past. One, as Mr. Gross talked about, this court has said repeatedly that lump sums are disfavored. Adopting this standard turns that rule on its head. Two,
is there anything in the current law, the way the legislature has put it, or the past, that says that it's disfavored? I know
yes.
That used to be in the past when I was with the Department of Labor, it was disfavored. But this was never a law in those days. Does this law make that statement inaccurate?
No, the current law doesn't use the word or the term disfavored, mm-hmm. but it severely limits when a claimant can obtain a lump sum. And that was my third of the three things that claimant's proposal would do. The third thing is it ignores the plain language of 6276, which says if you are permanently and totally disabled, you can obtain a lump sum for two reasons. One, if you have exceptional financial need, or two, to pay your attorney's fees. Now, I've heard I read in at least one of Mr. Groh's briefs something to the effect that a claimant has a right to a lump sum. Well, that's not true. Under South Dakota law, the department has to approve it, and it has to meet these standards.
And that second issue, to pay his attorney's fees, That isn't even an issue before us, is it? He's going to get a the lawyer is Mr. Groves is going to get a lump sum attorney fee.
He already has.
How much? He already has. All right. So the only thing we have to decide then is it in the claimant's best interests, and is there an exceptional financial need? Is that right? In terms of deciding whether there should be a lump sum at all.
I think that there is perhaps some confusion, at least I'm confused, about whether best interests and exceptional financial need actually have to be read together. If you read 6276, I think literally, it says if you want a lump sum, it has to has to be in the claimant's best interest. But it goes on to say if you are permanently and totally disabled, you have to meet these two tests. I'm not sure that they were intended to be blended together. Now, as Justice Gilbertson said, now I can't think of the name of the case, but in one opinion, he said, this statute is somewhat ambiguous. So it's difficult.
Not really ambiguous, just somewhat.
Well, let's just get to the exceptional financial need. Mr. Groves agrees that has to be shown. He has made a statement saying that it has been shown. What's your position on that?
He's not shown exceptional financial need. The claimant has said that I have exceptional financial need because I can get a better deal with a lump sum than without. Now, at the beginning of Mr. Groves' argument, he talked about the fact that this claimant's income has been reduced substantially, but that's true for every workers' compensation claimant at some level. Now, of course, the reason it's reduced by a third, at least, you know, the policy stated reason is that it's not subject to income tax. And so that factor has to be taken into account. But for the most part, based on my experience, ironically, I haven't been doing this as long as Mr. Groves. I have more gray hair, but I haven't been doing this as long. In my experience, almost every claimant ends up with something substantially less than what they were earning.
So give me an example then of what would be an exceptional financial need for a lump sum then.
A number of past due bills, debt that's, you know, there's a collection action has been commenced. And that's been the standard. That was the standard or one of the standards for payment of a lump sum before the statute was changed. So my point, I guess, on this particular issue is that if we follow claimant down the path that he wants to lead us, I think the court would have to overrule Thomas and Enger, and quite frankly, the court would have to ignore the plain language of 6276 because that is not the standard that's in 6276. And what we would end up with, I think, as a practical matter, is considerably more lump sum settlements than we have today, which could well have a dramatic impact on any number of insurers. And in particular with the state, I mean, this is a state-funded workers' compensation program. They have a budget that doesn't necessarily take into that assumes that most benefits are going to be paid periodically. They don't assume that benefits are all going to be paid in a lump sum or that a large percentage of them are. So there is a practical consequence to adopting the rule.
Doesn't it seem like in 6276 that the law, the wording of the law in dealing with the exceptional financial need and the necessity to pay the attorney's fees and costs, talk specifically about the permanent total disability. So doesn't it seem as if the legislature, by mentioning that, is more concerned of the employee that is permanently totally disabled?
Well, Justice Meyer-Henry, I presume you're referring to the last sentence just
right
before the numbered section.
Right.
And I think that's correct, and that makes logical sense. If you assume that the best interest standard that's further up in the section refers to people with temporary disabilities, those folks are folks that either are working part-time or it's anticipated they will go back to work and will have a means of earning an income. Permanently and totally disabled claimants, on the other hand, by definition, aren't going to be able to work, or if they do, it'll be part-time at an insubstantial income, I think is the statutory standard. So there is a difference, I mean, and there's a logical reason for that, I believe. If the court should get to the subject of whether the rule is was improperly adopted or should be updated, just a couple of quick points on that. One, I think it's important to remember that 6276 does not use the term equivalent lump sum amount as a standalone undefined term. The very next sentence of that section says, that amount shall be determined by, and it sets out a process for doing it. Now, it's true that there's nothing in the statute that says, and when the department sets its interest rate, it shall consider these factors. That is true. But it's inappropriate, I think, for the claimant to argue that equivalent lump sum, as used in the statute, has to have the, a dictionary meaning or a meaning given to it by economists. Other parts of the statute and rulings of this court have shown that that's not the case. For example, the court in, I believe it was in Ackley, I believe that was Justice Gilbertson's opinion, where he talked about this statute being a bit ambiguous, said that when the department determines what a lump sum or what the total of probable future payments will be, it is supposed to take into account the cost of living increase, but not Social Security, not the Social Security offset, the Social Security old age benefits offset. So there's one, we've artificially changed or made a change from what otherwise might be the dictionary or economist definition of the phrase equivalent lump sum. And similarly, the 3% cap on COLAs that's in 6247, to the extent that relates here, there's another artificial cap. Essentially, I would submit, and if I could close with this thought, I would submit that what the claimant wants to do, we have to keep in mind that this is not a precise science. That this is, these numbers are based on guesses, essentially, hopefully educated guesses, but educated guesses about how long someone's going to live, what's going to happen with inflation in the future, what's going to happen with interest rates in the future, and what the claimant wants to do is substitute his expert's guesses for the department's expert's guesses. And I would submit to the court that's not appropriate, and it would be a case of the court putting itself in the place of the legislature.
Thank you, Mr. Engel. Mr. Groves, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. This is not a case about lawyers. This is a case about injured people. There's a difference between the legislature saying 3% and the Department of Labor saying 1%. 3% is a statute. It's a legislative direction. 1% is an administrative rule that does not conform to equivalency. There's no way to read equivalent lump sum amount other than equal. If a legislature had intended something different, they could have said so. They didn't. The issue about an artificial cap, it's not artificial. The legislature can state specifically what they want, and the legislature gets what they want. Department of Labor should. The Department of Labor should not be allowed to vary the standard set by the legislature. And the court has said that repeatedly. It cannot expand authority. I disagree respectfully with Mr. Engel that there are circumstances, what is exceptional. If the court wants to open what the insurance company would call the floodgates of litigation, they will be opened. And the floodgates of litigation are, what is exceptional financial need? I mean, is it a car? Is it a home? Is it a bill? Is it a credit card debt?
What is this exceptional need? And what's the standard the Department of Labor is going to establish on each one of these various aspects? What is being suggested here is there are certain classes or certain kinds of need that we will recognize as a basis to divert monies to a need that is different than the established purpose under Thomas is to preserve income, produce the income over the lifetime. We're diverting money. It's clearer in anger that the lady wanted a home. I entirely understand and agree that to divert those assets, that weekly income, that monthly income, to buying something isn't in her interest.
But what makes your client, if I'm reading the statute correctly, you can correct me if my question's wrong, but what makes your client an exception from all the other totally disabled claimants who want their lump sum payments for the same reason your client wants it?
If I assume that there's no other stated need from anyone, probably not. I mean, I'm just answering your question candidly as I can.
But we have to, you know, we always say we have to read the statute and read all the words. So I look at the word exceptional, and I think it means that there has to be an exception from all the other claimants.
Your Honor, I don't know if I can read it that way. It says an exceptional financial need that arose as a direct result of the work accident. And the problem, the only thing I can come to and I can see there, other than diverting money, is that there's a loss. And this, in this case, and I think in many cases, this case has a 50% loss of income. It's huge. I don't know how people deal with it. It's huge. And to say that that's not, my judgment at least, that that's not exceptional, I think begs the question. I think it's clear that that's exceptional. That's hardship. That's poverty. And we're not, so I think that's really difficult to say that's not exceptional. You know, the statute doesn't say what exceptional is. It doesn't say mine's better than yours better. And I mean, I went through this. I don't understand how the Department of Labor would, other than applying a financial analysis, and that's what this court has said. It's primarily a financial analysis. It says it in Thomas, it says it in Anger. So if you do the financial analysis, this is what it shows. Now, it doesn't matter if it's 1% or 3%. Let's go back to this a little bit. If the present value is calculated at 1% or 3%, Mr. Steinmetz, unless he gets a lump sum and can do the investment, his weekly benefit doesn't change. It doesn't change. Right now he's getting approximately $245 a week from workers' compensation.
Well, it'll change next year, won't they? I mean, they'll look at the percent, what the COLA.
Sure. But I thought I understood that if it's figured at 3%, the present value, and the lump sum's figured at 3%, the attorney's paid on 3%, that would in some way affect the amount he gets a week. It doesn't. It doesn't change it. Because the way that's done is the benefit, the weekly benefit, is reduced by the percentage that the department approves the fees at. Then the worker's benefit continues to escalate under the statute at 3%. Now, but if he's allowed a lump sum with a true equivalent value, then there's a greater source of money, a greater lump sum value, to do an investment to return continuous income at regular intervals over his lifetime.
Clarify something for me. You just said something. He was given a 3%, right? When he was given his amount that he was to receive, your percentage of your attorney's fees, was that based upon his 3% award?
No.
It was based upon the 1%.
Yeah. It, see,
okay, I just wanted to clarify that. I got a little confused.
Sure, what happened was Mr. Engel and I, and he was very agreeable in this case. That's why we have a stipulated record. We recognize the significance of the issue, and we decided this is the way we get it to the court. He recognized that I had provided a valuable legal service to my client. And he stipulated and agreed that the fee should be based on the percentage at 25%. It doesn't say that, but that's what the percentage, that's what it represents. And the percentage was of the Department of Labor's calculation under the AR, preserving the right to bring this issue to the court on equivalency, on best interests, on, you know, the rest of this. So, I mean, I just think this diverting money, I mean, this gets to be crazy. I mean, and it creates, when you look forward at what does someone have to do to show, to create simplicity, do you say, well, the purpose is to preserve income, but in this circumstance, we'll allow you to divert money. And you know lawyers. If you give them a toehold, they're going to struggle with it and fight it. They're going to find exceptions and differences. And I think because the court has said the purpose is to create regular continuous income, that should be the purpose. And I think that simplifies. I think it streamlines. I think it creates certainty, and it makes everybody's ability to run these things much clearer.
What do you say to the economics argument counsel made about, you know, if we now look at these cases the way that you're arguing for your client, that's going to change state's budgeting process and so forth and so on.
You know, in my reply brief, you know, I didn't mean to be cavalier, but I say in the very one of the last several paragraphs of my reply brief that argument is wholly wrong. Wholly wrong. Those aren't my words in the brief, but it's wrong. And the reason it's wrong is if an insurer, or if the state, it's the state sits as an insurer in this case. They're no different than any other insurer, and it's no different. So if the insurer knows that the statute provides for a 3% cost of living increase, their actuarial studies have to include that calculation in creating reserves and planning for the future and setting premiums. That's the way it's done. To say that if you get a lump sum, you get 1%, you know, quite frankly, you're shortchanging the benefit to the employee, and second, the department shortchanged the benefit to the employee, and they have not given the employer what they bought.
Your time has expired, Mr. Gross. Thank you. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.